welcome you to your first seminar on this studying social and cultural change in the UK in the 1970s. The 1970s. Why the 1970s? Well, firstly, because I know the 1970s extremely well. But also, it might be, you know, it's a slightly different choice. When we think of, you know, the big decade which changed culture, you know, the big decade of liberation, we always think about the 1960s. Because the austerity of wartime had gradually worn down and there was more money to be had. The economy was very prosperous. There was zero unemployment. There were quite a number of strikes in the 1960s, but they were very short because they won immediately. This was the 1960s because the workers had a lot of power. For example, when there was no unemployment, I remember my father in 1967 had an argument with the foreman, and the foreman said, "You need to do more work. You need to do that light." And my father said, "No, I'm leaving." And he left on Thursday, and he got another job on Monday. Spoiler, don't do this. The world has changed. Yeah. And that was really that easy. And so you can imagine that people had, certainly workers had a lot of confidence. Yeah, you didn't get messed about much. So often we think about the 60s, and also the 60s, we think about the legalization of abortion in 1967, the generalization of contraception, the abolition of capital punishment, the legalization of male homosexuality. Yeah, the 60s. So let's have a look at the 70s. Now, the 70s is interesting because, as intellectuals like to say, it's very liminal. It's very liminal. Yeah, it was the end of the boom and the beginning of the crisis. In French, you have this wonderful expression I've probably already spoken to you about, les trente glorieuses. 45 to 75. And it sounds a little overblown and arrogant to say the 30 glorious years. It does correspond in some ways. I think there's a good reason for that. First of all, I mean, in Britain, of course, we don't say the 30 glorious years. Anybody know what we say? Anybody remember what we say? That's the one, yes. Yes, that's exactly the one. On Pupadil, the 30 glorious years. The post-war boom. The post-war boom. Because the essential thing about the trente glorieuses is that the economy was going extremely well and unemployment was very low. And poverty, although there was poverty was going down very, very regularly. So the post-war boom is normally considered to be 45 to 75. And in any case, in Britain, in 1976, the Labour government had a problem of financing, and they had to go to the International Monetary Fund and ask for a lot of money, a loan. And the International Monetary Fund said, "Yes, we'll give you the money if you close some more hospitals and you reduce your education budget." Yeah. This is the new world. This is after the boom. This is what it looks like. And so the 1970s is very, very exciting because you've got the end of the boom and the beginning of the crisis. And it took a long... First of all, the crisis was very, very shocking because, like today, in Britain, you say, "Oh, yeah, a million unemployed." People are not surprised. It's been a million and then more and then less and then more. But in 1975, the first time it got to a million, it was incredible because during the boom, as I often say in French, après 29 ans, des 30 glorieuses, les gens, ils étaient pas là, c'était, il nous reste qu'une année. On the contrary, everybody was convinced it would last forever. Everybody was convinced that homelessness, large-scale homelessness and unemployment had disappeared forever. This is why I'm rather lucky in a way, because I was brought up in this time, and people were so optimistic. The left wing was optimistic and the right wing was optimistic. The left wing was optimistic because 1968 in France and, you know, we're going to get rid of capitalism. And the right wing was optimistic because capitalism is working so well. Everybody was optimistic. And it's a really, it's not like that today. You've probably noticed. Yeah? It's a really bizarre thing. Now, these are difficult things to talk about. The general atmosphere. How can you measure optimism? And so this is why I want us to look at social and cultural change in the 1970s, which is all around, really, as you are not surprised to hear, what is history? What is easy and difficult about writing a history of the 1970s? The first problem is it's not very far away. And so you can still have people around, lots of people around, who were there, who can talk about it. And of course, they don't agree with each other. So if everybody disagrees, how do you write a history? How can you divide the interpretation from the facts? We'll be looking at some of that. But the 1970s had a lot going for it. Certainly the women's movement was stronger in the 1970s than in the 1960s, and stronger than in the 1980s or the 1990s or the year 2000. The women's movement was, for the only time since the Second World War, it was a mass movement. In every town, there were three or four meetings every week. So it wasn't just a campaign with a few famous people and a demonstration from time to time, like it is in Britain today. We have women's liberation groups. I would not call it today a movement. I would call it a network. And that, the reason for that is I consider if there's not 10,000, 20,000 people involved, for me it's not a movement. A movement is big. Yeah. I'm not saying they're doing bad work, but nevertheless they're mostly networks, rather than actually a movement as such. Are you looking okay? Good, good. Okay, right. It's all right, I'm only teasing you. So, in particular, social history and cultural history. We looked at this a little bit about the First World War, where social history was a concentration on social structures. You know, what is happening to the family? What is happening to trade unions? What is happening to strikes? What is happening to class structures? What is happening to people's ideas of you know, what is normal in society? The social history, cultural history, as we discovered, and I will see again, very, very difficult to define. Very important, but very, very difficult to define. Where does it begin and where does it end? So that's where I'm going to start, I think. Well, so this is slightly bizarre because all my notes are actually in French, but I'm giving it in English. So you know. So this will be okay. So here we're going to have a look then at cultural history. Today, first of all, in very, very general, I'm going to go back to the 19th century and say, what is cultural history? And I will do most of this standing up, but I've been working a long time today, so I might sort of lean on the desk or something from time to time. Cultural history from the beginning, with a concentration on the rise, in fact, the domination of cultural history after the 1980s. I'm mostly going to concentrate on Britain, but I have a few examples from France and from the United States. What is history and what is it for? This is one book which, if you get into thinking about history, I highly recommend this. Jeff Eady's book, A Crooked Line, from Cultural History to the History of Society. And one of the things he said was important about history, and he wanted to study, how does the past get worked into arresting images and coherent stories? Because this is the idea that if you take the 1970s, a million things happened. It doesn't make a story. Yeah. You know, sometimes when you read a biography or you see a biopic, one of the difficulties is it's all a very coherent story, whereas if you look at your own life, it's a bit of a mess. You know, this, you started doing this, and then you started doing this, and so on. So Eady is interested in how do we use history, and how do we make it into arresting images, des images frappantes, arresting that, des images frappantes. We know this if we discuss with people about Israel and Gaza. You know, there's just a very, we forget most of the history we read, and we remember certain images, yeah, which really hold there, which is very important. And the second thing is very important for Eady. He says he wanted to know, how does history get pulled and pummeled and made into reasons for acting? You know, how does it encourage, how does an understanding of history encourage people to do things differently? These are very complex ideas. Certainly the vernacular idea we hear very often, it's important to study history so we do not repeat the mistakes of the past. On peut dire que c'est raté, donc. Yeah. I don't think when you look at the world today, you say, oh, yes, humanity is not making the same mistakes anymore. Well done, humanity. Not really, yeah? Now, I don't mean that it never changes. Certainly, in particular groups, for example, you know, film directors or military generals or women's liberation activists, these individual groups might study the history of their movement and not make the same mistakes. That's possible. But a general idea that we, I don't know who that. We are not making mistakes because we understand history. It's just excessively naive. So why do people study history? I don't know. Partly people study history because it's obligatory. It's on the curriculum. Yeah. But I think when people like history, I think that people like to feel connected to the past. Just like we like to feel connected, we sometimes study science, or astronomy, or we watch a film about planets because we like to feel connected to where do we fit in. And I think that history is rather like that. We like to feel connected to the past. Here I have another quote about history. This is from a wonderful book by Richard Evans. I haven't put the date on there. You should never do that. You should always put the date. I think it's 2021. It's a biography of Eric Hobsbawm written by Richard Evans. And these are the two greatest British historians, Eric Hobsbawm. You're lucky because Richard Evans is still alive, and you can find his lectures on YouTube, and he's just so good. He's an amazing guy. But he wrote a biography of Eric Hobsbawm, and this comes from there. It says, Brodel, the French historian, a very great historian, once told me, says Hobsbawm, he said, historians are never on holiday. On vacation, they're always, so to speak, on the job. Whenever, he said, I get into a train, I learn something. And I think it's very important because this is another way of saying be open to new phenomena. That he's saying, that history is not easy. There's always something new happening. There's always, like all the things many people have learned in the last 20 years about gender. Well, that it's not as fixed as we thought it was. Oh, my God. This also gives us a new way of looking at things in history, which we can do well or badly, But it's there's always new questions coming up, which sometimes come from the present, but give us a way of looking at the past. So we get back to the 1970s. If you imagine somebody writing a chapter of a school book, and the title of the chapter was The History of Britain in the 1970s. This is what happened. This really happens to historians. The people really do. Hey, I went to Britain in the 1970s. 8,000 words. Can you do it by March? This happens to me sometimes. And so I have to decide what is important. I also have to decide what the publishers will find acceptable. Yeah, because otherwise they say no. So for example, how important are military events in the 1970s? How important is the royal family if you're speaking for French people, for example? How important are changes in technology in the home? Now that's a slightly different sort of historical event, isn't it? Because changes in technology in the home, the 1970s is the rise of the fridge. And fridges are only important if you don't have one. If you don't have a fridge, you go shopping every day or almost every day. It's quite a big deal, especially for women. But it's different because, it's not an event like the coronation or a new law. It's not a political. It's just a change, which is not an event. And so that's one of the things historians have to do. How much do we want events, and how much do we want changes in people's lived experience? Elections, well, I think everybody, most histories will say, oh, yeah, there was an election. Yes, please.
Do you need us to, do you need to validate our topic?
Yes. That's right, yeah.
So we send you an email.
Yeah, exactly. He's following. Yeah, il comprend vite, mais il faut lui expliquer longuement. Yeah, okay. Yeah, no, it's fine. It's okay. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you think of a subject and you send me an email. And usually I say yes, but I sometimes say, oh, that's too broad. Can we narrow it down a bit? Thank you for the question. Popular music. Now, traditionally in history, if you just buy a normal history, France in the 1940s, you will probably find there's almost nothing about popular music. So, of course, that doesn't keep me happy. I always begin my research interventions with the same sentence every time. Popular music does not illustrate history. I always begin like that. Popular music does not illustrate history. It is a series of mass activities which are part of history. The way people work is part of history. The way people use music is part of history. my thing, yeah? So this is something you'd have to decide. How important is popular music in people's lives? And of course, some people say, it's just to help them relax. It's not important. Yeah. If they listen to popular music or they play football, it doesn't matter. That's not really history, some people would say. So these are questions. Strikes. Now, I should say elections will be, as we will see, quite important in the history of the 1970s because there were a lot of them. 1970, there was an election. 1974, there was an election. 1974, there was another election. 1976, there was an election. 1979. Five general elections in 10 years. This is what you call a political crisis. If you have two general elections the same year, it does happen in France, but not recently. It hasn't happened recently in France. And then the women's movement. The 1970s was the years of the women's movement. And of course, it was not... it was not only a wonderful movement where everybody agreed with each other. Of course not. People disagreed all the time. And nevertheless, a lot of things happened. And we will see some of them as I go through the chronology. We'll see some very original initiatives that you would never have guessed. And quite often, journalistic history will only look at the most dramatic elements of the women's movement. Just like when you look at a general history which mentions the suffragettes, they only talk about hunger strikes and dying in front of horses and burning houses. You know, most of it, you know, there's a lot more to do. There was a lot more to do, you know. And journalists are allowed to be only interested in the most dramatic, but historians are not. It's a bit like being a priest, being a historian. There's very strict rules. You have to take it very, very seriously. It's like a religion. I have a couple of people working with me on the 19th century, and I tell them, I want you to wake up in the morning thinking like you're a 19th century woman. So I tend to try to frighten my doctoral students. What questions are important? Of course, it's a matter of opinion, but you could justify them. So if I say popular music is important, I could say why. So I would say, well, young people are becoming more independent in the 1970s. And deciding what kind of music they are attached to is an important part of young people's identity. I could say that it's not an accident that punk rock appeared when the crisis began. It's not an accident. If in 1955, the Sex Pistols had begun singing, "No future, there is no future." You say, 1950, people, what are you talking about? I'm much richer than my father, and my children will be much richer than me. What do you mean, no future? That punk has got to be the music which comes from the crisis. So that would be some of my arguments to say, oh yes, we must make sure we talk about popular music. But of course, somebody else would say, oh yes, this is more important, that is more important. So people could oppose. So if you take the women's movement, somebody might say, oh, well, yes, okay. There were probably 50,000 or 100,000 women in women's groups, but there are 20 million women in Britain. So really, we don't need to really talk about the women's movement because it was a minority thing. Lots of discussions and debates are possible here. Now, we've never sufficiently asked for... This is my structure, in fact. Why do we have history and why do we have cultural history? I apologise for being in French, but your French is okay, yeah? Thank you. Why and how did cultural history rise and become dominant in the 1980s? What does cultural history look like at the university today? A little bit about cultural history and memory. And finally, a couple of words about thick description. Thick description. Now, thick is a difficult word in English because it means épaisse, but it also means épaisse like stupid. Il est un peu épais. Yeah? He's a bit stupid. He's a bit thick. It's not a nice word. It's an insult word. Yeah? You don't use it too easily. So those are just a few thoughts. A few years ago, I was very lucky, and I went to Washington. And I went to the... Anybody recognize it? This is the Museum of African American History. And it was opened 10 years ago. It was opened about approximately 10 years ago. It's enormous. It took them 40 years to establish it, as you can imagine, the Museum of African American History could also sometimes be controversial. They had to find a lot of money. I think this must be about 25 euros what you need to build a museum like that. A lot of the money they got from black businessmen. This is America, yeah, this is not France. Yeah. If you get in France, the Cité de l'Immigration in Paris, which is not the same at all, but you know, it was built with public money, not with private money. So that's one thing. But the other thing is that this is in the center of Washington, opposite the Washington Monument, which is extremely, so they're saying this is centrally important to America. The position of, the place of a museum is very important. If you go to Berlin, there is a museum of the German resistance to fascism. You have to take bus number 26 and then change and get bus number 14. It's out in the, not at all in the center of Berlin. So the positions of museums are always very important. So it's in the center, and when you walk in, you get the map. Welcome to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Okay, so history and culture, these appear to be two different things. And here you have the map. On the top floor, you have culture galleries. And under in the basement, you have history galleries. Okay, we've got culture over there, history over here. Okay. And between them, we have community galleries and Heritage Hall. So the map of the museum is showing us something, not easy to interpret, about what they think about the experience of being black over the last few hundred years in the United States. Some things here we're not surprised at, because this is the United States, we're not very surprised to see the word community. Community in the United States and in France, the United States and in the UK, is a very positive word. There was a new left-wing political organisation in Britain in the 1990s called Respect, and the R stood for something, and the E stood for something, and the C stood for community. So, you know, what's important? Communities. And of course, as you know, the political configuration in France is very different. And in France, the word communauté, communautarisme, it can often be a rather negative idea of we're keeping our group separate. Whereas in Britain and America, and if you want to keep me happy, please do not say in Anglo-Saxon countries. Y'a que en France qu'on dit les pays anglo-saxons. It annoys British people because when I went to the United States, I feel more abroad than in Poland. I mean, it is so alien. I love the United States, but it's just not, you know, les pays anglo-saxons. It doesn't work for me anyway. Okay, so that's what we see. And so what do we see inside the galleries? Well, here in the culture section, this is not in the history section. It's in the culture section. And we see this particular thing and what it is. It's actually fascinating and documented. It's a poster. It's an advert. And it's an advert by the National Baptist Publishing Board. So, as you can understand, a religious organization. And this religious organization sells dolls. Now, in most countries, religious organizations just don't sell dolls. They might sell statues of Our Lady. They don't sell dolls. And this is part of an anti-racist cultural campaign, which at this time, every child, if they were white or black, everybody had white dolls, only white dolls. And these people say, there's a problem here. We need the toys, or even the toys, we need to be represented everywhere, and so we're going to sell Negro dolls. This is the word they used at the time, Negro. It's today, you don't use that word, but at the time they did. And so you get this interesting moment in history when a religious organization was selling dolls to begin to resist racism. So it is history, but here it's in the culture section, it's not in the history section. The other thing also in the culture section is this reproduction of statues. Do you know what we can see here? Anybody know what I took the photograph in 2018, but the event is not from 2018. Anybody know? Yes?
It's the end of the Olympic Games.
It is, it's the end of the Olympic Games.
I remember what year exactly?
In some year,
it's
yes.
In 70s, I guess.
Yeah, uh-huh. Ish.
And, well, that's two black people and one white people, white person. That just, well, the two black people stand their hand, their fist to, I don't remember exactly why, but it was a stand.
A stand?
It was a stand against racism. And the white guy just stood up aside of them because he agreed with them.
That's right, yeah. They are on the podium, so this is the gold medal, the silver medal and the bronze medal. And you're quite right, this is in Black Power, in solidarity with the many, many events, including the riots going on in the United States at the time. So it's a moment in sports history, which was important. And as you're absolutely right, these are two black people, and the white man you cannot see, he's wearing a little badge in solidarity with them. So it was a moment when, first of all, sport was a place where it was a little easier for black people to rise. Yeah, if you wanted to become successful and rich as a black man, there was no point in going to get a job in a bank. You would never get to the top, never. It was just completely racist banks, you would never get there. Sport was a little easier. It's pretty hard work, of course. That's why I decided to become a university teacher and not a sports star. Very good, nobody laughed. Good, okay. So, again, in the culture section, elements which could be considered to be history. Now, I showed you this last year that social history has quite a good definition. History of society, of social behaviour, history with an emphasis on social structure. And however, I will also put the PowerPoint on the blog as well. And also, nevertheless, people did argue for a long time about social history. And this particular, in one issue of the influential magazine History Today, they had a long debate with seven different historians about what is social history. Is it a new form of antiquarianism? Is it simply because you? Is it simply like a nostalgia about objects from the past? Is it celebrating experience at the expense of analysis? There's been a real rise of, if we're looking at history, we want to understand people's experience from the past. But that's a new idea. Before social history, people's experience, we don't care about people's experience. We want to know, why was there an economic crisis? Why was there a war? And people's experience is not going to explain this to us. That was the old idea. Also, many people believed at the beginning, social history, c'est l'histoire écrite par les gauchistes. Aujourd'hui, c'est plus moderne. Nous sommes islamo-gauchistes. Mais avant, c'était seulement gauchiste. And so these are the questions. Do you have to be left-wing to write social history? It's an interesting question. It's not completely true, no. It's not completely true. Oh, there you go. Is social history a way of rescuing the past from the enormous condescension of posterity? Now, I probably said this to you last week, but that's a long time ago. I'm sure you've forgotten. This is a quotation from E.P. Thompson, and he says, one of the problems with historians is if you look at the past, if you're not careful, you think, oh, can you see how stupid people were in the past? Oh, they did all these stupid things because we did differently now. And you have to be very careful of this. People in the past had good reasons for doing what they did. And also, we shouldn't be too arrogant because in 50 years' time, people will be looking at us and saying, oh my God, can you see how stupid they were? Yeah. And so he says that, the enormous condescension of posterity is something we want to avoid. That is to say, we want to understand why, for example, if you go back to the 15th century, 16th century in Britain, and you have big fighting between the Catholics and Protestants, they had good reasons for this. It wasn't just because they were so much less intelligent than us. In fact, they weren't less intelligent for us. So the point of this is to show something about the argument that happens around history is. Well, this is wonderful. I have a list of slides here, and it's not exactly the same as on there. So let's see if I can pretend that I know what I'm doing. We will get there in a moment. Okay, so I'm going to give you a little history of cultural history. So this is historiography. Who was the first cultural historian? How did he do it? This was difficult for him, because for a very long time it was considered, certainly until the 19th century, most historians considered that history is the politics of the past. And politics is the history of the present. So if you wanted to write history, you had to say, you know, who was king? What were the big decisions they made? What were the conflicts between the different parties? And that's it. History is the politics of the past. That was the old idea of history. And cultural history will come to challenge this. And probably the first person to do it is this Jacob, good old Jacob Burckhardt. He was a Swiss historian. He wrote in German. There you can see him. This book was first published in 1860, and you can see here the first edition was in German, but here you have the edition in English. The Civilization of the Renaissance in History. Now, this was not necessarily very popular with him at the time, because he was mocked by some of the best known historians at the time. What he did he was mocked by the most famous historians of the time. In particular, for example, this gentleman. This gentleman, if you're working on history, you have a lot to thank Leopold von Ranke for, because he invented how you use a historical source. He said, "Oh well, what you do is you make sure that the person knows exactly where the source comes from." That it's his fault. Okay. So this was Leopold von Ranke. He was a very conservative gentleman, extremely rigorous historian. So okay, show me that this comes from reliable sources and that you can identify the sources. This was Leopold von Ranke. Interestingly, his idea of history was to seek the hieroglyph of God. So the idea is that God created the world, but it's difficult to understand, so we're trying to understand God's creation. That's von Ranke. And he was not impressed at all with Jacob. He was not impressed because in his book, The Civilization of the Renaissance in Italy, he worked on political sources, but he also worked on, he used, for example, works of art, paintings, as evidence of historical change. So he widened the idea of what is a source. And one of the very important characteristic of cultural history is widening the idea of what is a source. Probably the next people who were crucial in cultural history were Johann Huizinga, who published this book in 1919. He was from the Netherlands. This is the French version. I can't pronounce the Hefstage der Middeleeuwen. Yeah. And you can see that it says in his introduction, this is a study of the forms of life, thought, and art. Life, thought, and art. This is not just the politics of the past. It's much, much more life. Thoughts and arts have gone much wider. And so, l'automne du Moyen-Âge, now in this particular edition in French, it has a preface by Jacques Le Goff. Jacques Le Goff is one of the great French historians of the Middle Ages. Yeah, the sort of people, unfortunately, he died quite a long time ago, but a very, very impressive gentleman. So this was a grandfather, if you like, of cultural history. I don't mean that he necessarily used the word. He probably didn't say, this is cultural history. But he decided that history must be much wider than politics. It must include thought and art. Only 20 years later or so, you have the book of G.M. Young, Jeffrey, I think his name is, Victorian England Portraits of an Age. And in the word portrait, perhaps you can see, it sounds artistic, doesn't it? It doesn't sound scientific. A portrait, we're going to paint a portrait. We're going to try to find, like a good portrait, you can really see not just the physical, but also the personality. So this is the idea that, you know, you have to find the ways. And this reminds us also that historians have two jobs, not just one. The historian has two jobs. Number one, to discover truths about the past, and number two, to communicate those truths. Because if you write books which are so boring nobody wants to read them, then you're not really a very good historian, even if you find really good facts. There's a guy who wrote a fabulous book about the English Civil War, and the book is great, but he gives lectures, and literally I've been to one of his lectures. At the beginning there are 200 people. And after half an hour, there's only 20 people left. He's so boring. People just walk out. Poor old guy, Brian Manning. I don't know why he doesn't stop giving lectures. The next example from the 1920s. Three classics of cultural history here. Next example from the 1920s. This is Marc Bloch, also the author of a very influential book on historiography, Le métier de l'historien, c'est lui qui l'a écrit. But this book was very, very, very new idea. It was Les Rois Thaumaturges, that is to say, it's a history over quite a long period. Which period? We've got the period here. Yeah, it just says a long period. Well, this long period, and he studies what people believed about the capacity of a king to heal. Because for many, many years in the 15th, 16th century, people believed that if you were ill, if you touched the clothes of the king, you would get better. And so what he decided to do is wanted to write a history of this idea, the idea that kings have magical healing power. Spoiler, they don't. So this is interesting. So you see, he's not at all looking at the politics of the past. He's looking at how did people see the world. Here we are in the history of representations, and that's very much one of the central themes of cultural history, is the history of representations. What did things mean to people? Not just what happened, but what did it mean to people? I gave you an example last year with food in the First World War. And one of the problems they had in France with the British soldiers is the British soldiers refused to eat horse. Even if they were hungry and there was no food, they wouldn't eat horse. So this caused a military problem, actually. They had loads of horses and nothing else. Great book by Marc Bloch, Les Rois Thaumaturges. I don't know what the title of the translation in English is. Now, it's not surprising that it is during the post-war boom that cultural history will begin to become much more popular. There are two reasons for this. The first reason is simply mathematical or statistical. That is that because the economy was getting more prosperous around the world, industry was getting much more complicated, companies were getting much bigger, they needed far more universities. The number of people going to university in 1950 was very, very small. And as you know, today they allow anybody to come to university. Okay, so they opened more and more universities, and because the universities were not supposed to be very strictly to help the chemical industry or to help the car industry, but they were supposed to be also a sign that the system was helping general education and the development of human personality, every university had a history department. So the number of historians in 1970 is like five times more than the number of historians in the 1950s. So the number of historians is just getting hugely more important after the post-war boom. And so more historians, quite often means more questions asked. The second thing is that the people who became historians in the 70s, in the 80s, very often they just came from ordinary families. The historians who were historians in the 1930s, generally they came from the bourgeoisie. If you went to university, it's because you came from a high class. But later on, and especially during the post-war boom, the university could be what you call in French the ascenseur social. Ça existe encore, mais parfois ça descend plutôt que monter. Yeah. So the idea is so you know somebody who is the son of a working class man could end up as a history professor. Oh, that's me. Oh well, there you go. I'm famous at last. So this was the time when cultural history was on the rise, and we have two more classics of cultural history, social and cultural history, from this period. The first one here, then, in French, here, la formation de la classe ouvrière anglaise. In English, it is the making of the English working class. And it's about the period when industry was slowly rising and no longer about working at home, because the beginnings of industry in Britain were every Monday the boss came round and gave you some textile, and every Thursday he came and took away what you had made with it. That's the putting out system. Before the factories and the gradual introduction of factories. And what he wanted to study is the making of the English working class. So it's an interesting idea. The idea is that the working class did not appear. It was made, and it made itself. And so it's all about how did people begin to think, oh, I'm a worker. We are a working class. Where did that come from? And it's quite complex. And this was a very, very influential book by E.P. Thompson. Another classic, which is one of my absolute favourites from 1971, is Religion and the Decline of Magic by Keith Thomas. And he, as often, very, very new, what's the word, very, very new questions, sorry, very, very good historians ask new questions. The big tragedy is that this has not been translated into French. So if you have some spare time, take quite a long time, wouldn't it? He discovered something. He studied the court cases, the tribunal, the records of the tribunals. Now, historians love tribunals because tribunals write everything down. Remember, we're talking about most people could not read and write in the 16th century. And so, you know, how do we know what they did and what they thought? Tribunals say, oh, they write of the prisoner says that he thought this and that he wanted this. They're wonderful. We love tribunals. Bit mean, really, but there you go. And so what he discovered when he looked at the tribunals in 1500, he found that most ordinary people thought that magic, witches, spells were part of everyday life. They were part of everyday life. You knew somebody in the village who could cast a spell to make your child better, or cast a spell to make your cow better if it was dying. And everybody, almost everybody, believed in magic and witches and this kind of thing. And he noticed that 200 years later, in the same tribunal, the same kind of tribunal records, nobody talked about magic. And so here he found a question. Why? Because of course, the best questions in history always begin with why. Why did magic disappear? And this is Religion and the Decline of Magic. Absolutely, absolutely wonderful book. So we see in Religion and the Decline of Magic, because it's about how did ordinary people see the world. So you see, we're a long way from the politics of the past. It's not about laws. It's about how they saw the world and how the advance of a sort of rationalist Protestantism gradually pushed magic down. So these are some of the typical priorities of cultural history. The importance of symbolic life. the importance of the representations which people have of the world around them. But really, it's after 1980 that cultural history, in particular in the UK and in the US, begins to dominate history departments in universities. Probably in the 90s and today, cultural history is like half of all the history books written in the universities. It's enormous. Which is not the case in bookshops and in school books. I know about France, actually. I looked in, my daughter is now 23, but when she was in the lycée a few years ago, I used to look at her school books, and it's political history. 90% political history. That's what it's laws and governments and wars and why that happened. And, so that continues to dominate in schools. Why? I don't know why. It would be interesting to see. But in universities, it was cultural history that was vastly dominant. And here is, which I did show you last year, but I'm going to show you again, my list of characteristics of cultural history. Not every book of cultural history has to have all these characteristics, but these are typical. First of all, the idea of culture is very, very wide, yes? Do you believe in magic to help your crops? That's culture. Yeah, so culture is not just, you know, opera and music and dancing. It's all the symbolic elements of life. Secondly, today, cultural history tries to move away, for the last 40 or 50 years, cultural history has tried to move away from some old ways of looking at culture. In particular, traditional art history. Now, traditional art history is here is a picture by El Greco. Which artists influenced El Greco, and which artists did El Greco influence? So it's about the relationship between works of art and history outside the work of art. Is not really very important. We see this in all kinds of music as well, where you have a book about the history of music, and very often it will really concentrate on two questions. First, which musicians influence which musicians? And secondly, how did the sonata develop? How did the symphony develop? How did chamber music develop? How did the instruments develop? So it was really music history locked into music. Whereas cultural history of music would be about how did music relate to people's lives and how did they see it? Now, one of the dangers of talking about culture is that you can suddenly become very vague. You know this. If you meet somebody who comes from Vietnam and you ask them, you say, "Tell me about your culture," and they're like, and just like you are, if you go to Vietnam and say, "Oh, tell me about French culture. What are French people like?" I don't know. We're kind of all a bit different. It's very, very difficult, and you can rapidly get into stereotypes and generalizations. So cultural historians will try to concentrate to some extent on what can be measured. So even if you are, interested in fashion in the 1970s, you might choose a Sunday newspaper, and you might begin by saying, well, how many pages are about fashion over these 10 years? So first of all, you want the numbers. If you're going to say it's important, you need the numbers to show it's important. Not just as, oh, this impression that it's important, yeah? So we try to measure things. When I wrote my book on popular song in the First World War, first of all, I collected 1,000 songs. First of all, I had 1,000 songs. And then I said, okay, how many of these are patriotic songs? How many of these are love songs? How many of these are comic songs? And so on. And what's good about having a corpus and a number is that I could say, patriotic songs are absolutely not them. They are a minority of about a quarter. And because I had the actual corpus, nobody could say, oh, I don't agree with you. It's an actual fact, yeah. And numbers are wonderful like that. Cultural history is very interested in what is symbolism, how important symbolism is. And we will come back to this. In general terms, it is history from below. It's ordinary people. We're interested in ordinary people. And finally, and this is more accidental, it is part of an intellectual compromise in universities. In the 1950s and the 1960s, Marxism was very influential in universities. As the 80s and the 90s went on, Marxism was losing an awful lot of influence. And also, it became not too safe to be a Marxist in a university. You might not get the best jobs. This happened to me to some extent. So the advantage of cultural history is that you didn't have to. You could work on ordinary people without talking about Marxism, and so that made it a little easier. And quite understandably, because Marxism is about completely changing society, quite understandably, established universities don't like to give money to Marxists because it's like, you know, give you money so that you can overthrow the whole thing. No, thank you. So this was all part of that. Nevertheless, there are some. So here are what have often been considered the strong points of cultural history, concentrating on lived experience, developing a much wider audience. Cultural history became very interested in, okay, we're writing history books, but who's reading them? How can we get history out into more people? What can we do with museums? Museums are more and more popular every year. The number of people going to museums is rising all the time. Cultural history has a much wider idea of what is a historical object. 50 years ago, you're studying 1,000 popular songs. Well, that's not history. That would not be considered history. Popular songs are stupid things which stupid people do. That's the very, very elitist view of the time. And finally, cultural history can be is often intended to be fairly interdisciplinary. That's right, interdisciplinary. We see some of this cultural history not only in universities. I don't know if any of you know the books by Ken Follett. These are novels. However, they are very carefully researched by a team of historians. Le Pied de la Terre is about the building of a cathedral in England. And Colin de Feu is a more recent one about the Renaissance. The Fall of Giants is about the First World War. And this is how I know his novels are good history, because I know the First World War and I read that one. It's really, really very, very well researched. And there's a whole load of them. And they sell very well. In fact, quite serious historical novels. Of course, there are historical novels which are not very serious, which are just, love and sex in the royal palaces of Versailles. But serious novels are going up. Serious historical novels are on the rise. And also in Britain in particular, not only in Britain, but in Britain in particular, there is a very rapidly rising consumption of history on the television. This kind of documentary series, is a perfect example. I don't know, you probably don't know these, but this is something which was very common in British history. Now, in British television, I'm not sure if British television actually invented it, but they produced more and more of it. And it's a very simple idea. Edwardian form. And remember when the Edwardian period is? Oh, album. Yes, sorry.
After the Victorian
one. Yes, that's right. Yeah, the Edwardian Victorians after the Victorian one. Before the First World War, after the Victorian one. So 1901 to, you can argue about when it finishes. Yes. So that's Edwardian times. So a farm at the very beginning of the 20th century. Okay, they managed to make a television series about this, and they got millions of people to watch it. And it's a very simple idea. They got a group of historians and they made them live for a year in the same way as you would live on an Edwardian farm with horses, no machines, horses, well, of course, I mean, no sophisticated machines, horses, planting the crops of the time, using the methods of the time. And these are real historians, but it's also a bit of a television adventure, you know. Oh my God, you know. And you get, and it's reality TV. It's also, oh my God, you know, when are they going to invent shampoo? Because people, especially people with long hair, if you're a 21st person, century person, it's really uncomfortable to have to live in Edwardian time. And they wore Edwardian clothes and so on. And they started this, and there are more and more of them. This one, for example, this is an American version, Frontier House, which is a house on the frontier. Well, and they will be eating the food of the time and wearing the clothes of the time and playing the games of the time with some commentary from historians. So it's not really a documentary, but it is based on fact. So it is a form of reality TV. I think this was the original one, the 1900 house. And what they did is they got a family, and this was slightly different because Edwardian farm and frontier house was a group of historians pretending to be in the past. In the 1900 house, they took a real family from today and they moved them back. They moved them into a house of the 1900s, so the gaslighting and so on, and they made them live like that for 2-3 months. And filmed, of course, their reactions. I think this may have been the first one, and they were hoping to get 1 million viewers, and they got 5 million. So they suddenly realised that, in fact, you know, people can be interested in this. And then, since then, there are more and more of them. Victorian Pharmacy. Most of these you could find some episodes on YouTube, and my favourite one, Back in Time from Brixton. They took a family of black people from London today and they said, we're going to make you live for 1 week like black people lived in London in the 1950s. And then for 1 week like black people lived in London in the 1960s. And you get a mix of sometimes just nostalgic stuff, you know, the furniture and the songs, and sometimes very, very heartbreaking stuff. They have visits from people who remember the time. And there was a black bus driver who said that in London in the 1950s, he would take the money and he would give the change. And many people would say, put the change on the seat. I don't want you to touch my hand. It's really things that are very, very good history, because it's something where you really feel the texture. Of course, it's very easy to. There was a lot of racism, and then there was a law against racism. That's boring history. It was actually people's real lives. So cultural history is also invading television. We also see a rise, partly because of the internet, of family history. It's easier to do family history today than it used to be, because the internet is very, very helpful. Does anybody here have anybody in their family who does family history? You know, who is it? Is your uncle or brother or
me?
You, right, okay. Okay, there you go. And is the internet the main place to look for stuff?
Yes and no. Well, the archive or City Hall, basically, yes. City Halls are the main places.
Okay. And do you occasionally contact people who...
Sometimes I find cousins and I just talk to them. They give me references and so we know each other.
Okay. Well, it's a rising thing. It was popular even 50 years ago in the United States. And then it came to Britain and then to France. Welcome back. Yeah, okay. That's enough of that. Now, just to finish on cultural history in general, some of the criticisms of cultural history, that it is sometimes suspected that cultural history can ignore important institutions and organisations such as the state or trade unions or political parties, that when cultural history says history is not just the politics of the past, the danger is it can sometimes say, oh, politics doesn't exist. But of course, politics does exist. And so you have to be careful about that. If you're not careful, you could suggest that culture is homogenous. We all know something about how women were expected to see themselves in the 19th century. The problem is that there are always exceptions. Every generally accepted idea is also contested in every area. And so cultural history, if it's not careful, can act as this, oh, well, the culture of France in the 1920s, as if there was only one, whereas in fact it's something which is quite movable. Cultural history has also been accused of not looking at some of the widest questions. Today, in China, the number of people living in villages is going down, and the number of people living in towns and working in factories is going up. Is this happening in the same way as it happened in Britain in the 19th century? I don't know, but this is a big question which cultural historians never don't look at these huge regularities, in particular of economic history. Yeah. And finally, yes, that you can get carried away with culture, just culture. Here are some recent examples of how the ideas of cultural history can become political. In Northern Ireland, as you know, there's been good news and bad news. The good news is that there's no war anymore. Yeah. However, the compromise made in 1997 in Northern Ireland, saying, OK, we'll change the police completely. OK, we will try to work against anti-Catholic racism. OK, we will have more cooperation between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. Still, leave in place some problems of discrimination against Catholics. And if you go to Belfast today, you still see painted on the walls, KAT, kill all Tags, kill all Catholics. Not good. And here is one of the laws that they are trying to pass in Northern Ireland to defend the right to speak Irish. Right to speak Irish, right to speak Irish Gaelic. And the unionists are trying to defend the idea that they have an equivalent orange culture. And this is a big argument, a big debate about it. You know, it's a bit like a sort of Black Lives Matter, all Lives Matter sort of debate going on. So culture can get into politics in a big way. So I just want to look at a couple of years ago. I was at the conference of the American Historical Association in Washington. It was it's the biggest association of historians in the world. I mean, the United States has more universities and more money, and they have more historians. They have a meeting every year with like 3,000 historians. And I just went around looking at some of the books. So with some of the books connected with cultural history. So he said, look, Breaking Bad, a cultural history, you know, the series Breaking Bad, a cultural history. So that opens up the question, you know, what would that look like, a cultural history of a television series, you know? What did it mean to people? How did the series represent society? But also, you know, how did... how important, well, I'm not going to do it. Let's try opening up. Can you open a window? I'm getting a little bit. I think I might die soon. Okay. Thank you so much. If she dies of cold, I'll feel very guilty. So this is obviously cultural history is an important thing here. And so what can it do with this? I have some more. This is all from the same year. A cultural history of Naples. So the idea is that a town has a culture which changes, not necessarily so easy to know exactly what they're going to talk about. This would be cultural history. A history of boxing in Mexico. And if you, I don't know if you can see the subtitle there. Masculinity, modernity, and nationalism. So here, this is a very good example because, of course, 50 years ago, you could read a history of boxing in Mexico, but it would just be a list of who won, just a sport, an old-fashioned history sport, who won, How did they become better at boxing? And so on and so forth. This is a history of boxing, a cultural history. So what did boxing mean to men in Mexico? Nationalism, where did this fit in? And what's the third one? Modernity. Boxing and modernity? I don't know what they said. I haven't read the book. So you can see that just something like boxing, which a traditional historian would say, well, that's not history. It's not politics. It's not history. It allows, and so it gets wider and wider. A cultural and social history of modern football. So you would expect this to say something about football, but a lot about what did football mean to people. For example, when I was young in England, if you were a boy, you were obliged to have your favourite team. It was not possible to say, oh, well, actually, I'm not interested in football. People didn't understand when you said that. So, yeah, but what team do you support? And interestingly enough, I supported Manchester United, but I wasn't very interested. And if somebody discovered that I didn't know the results of yesterday's match, then they would come out with an insult. And the insult was part-timer. Tu n'es qu'un supporter à temps partiel. So very, very interesting idea. Insults are very interesting, you know. Whereas, you know, it wasn't important to me. But yet, the idea of what did football mean to people is part of cultural history. And this was one of my favourites. One of my favourites. Sin in the 60s. Le Péché dans les années 60. Very good idea. What they simply did is they interviewed Catholics and they asked them about what the sacrament of confession meant to them. So why was it important to them? Okay, the sacrament of confession. Confession has changed a lot. Confession has generally been pretty important to Catholics. But it is on the decline, and also it's become much more informal. So quite often the priest will be much more relaxed about it. So you know how did the meaning of confession for Catholics change? So again, the difficult part of a historian's job is finding good questions. Answers, that's quite easy, and finding good questions, that one, which is why it sometimes happens, you know, that somebody I get called to be on the jury for a doctoral thesis, and the problem is that the question isn't very original. Maybe the work is okay, but you're asking a question which has already been asked. That's not what we prefer. I have one more here. American identity. Now that's much more difficult. Yeah, huge. A history of American identity. That feels a little bit dangerous. Yeah, how are you going to prove what you'd say about American identity? If you look on YouTube, you can find more cultural history. What will a cultural history of cars look like? I have no idea. But obviously somebody is asking the question. So cultural history is allowing us to look at many, many new subjects and considering them history, the cultural history of chess. So if we now have a look at universities in Britain and France, I did this 5 years ago, but I don't think anything has changed. There's a wonderful website in France called thèse.fr. It just lists all the doctoral theses that they can find. And so here I looked at theses being prepared in France in 2018. The result was 522 theses used the expression histoire culturelle. 522 theses out of 10,000 theses had the word histoire. And 500 of them had the word histoire culturelle. So we can see it's a significant content, but it's not dominant. And this is what we got in the other forms of the other kinds of thesis in France. in 2018 in preparation, not finished. These are theses which were not finished. They were being worked on. So the latest ideas, they might have finished by now. And you can see that it's quite a variety, but some expressions are not very popular. Diplomatic history, 4 theses. Okay. Military history, histoire militaire 35. Economic history, 30. Art, social history, 202. Histoire de mentalité, 5. Histoire de mentalité has gone down a lot because people begin to think, mentalities, you know, what on earth is that? Yes?
What's the difference between ideas and state of mind?
Yeah, what's the difference between histoire des idées and histoire de mentalité? Histoire des idées, I have nothing against histoire des idées. Okay, yeah. Let's say traditional history of ideas is very much criticized today because it's not always like this, but the worst kind of history of ideas is, here is a book by Montesquieu. I will look in this book by Montesquieu to find the influence of Voltaire, if I got them in the right order. And then I will say, how did this book influence? So it's just the history of books, but how books influenced each other. And today, most historians say, histoire des idées. We prefer intellectual history, which is the history of the ideas, but much more social context, much more, not just the influence of books between them. Histoire des mentalités is completely different. It's the idea of, what was the, for example, it's much more cultural history. It's much more like, what was the, there was a book on how patriotic were the working class in 1914. It's about mentalities. Ideas is about important writers and what they said and how they influenced each other. But you'll notice that there are 1,589 histoire de l'art. Okay, and so people prefer that. It might be because they think it's easier. And as you can see, there are now 15 histoire intellectuelle. The histoire intellectuelle is the first of the modernization of histoire des idées. And histoire des représentations, 39. And it was 500 on cultural history. Now, if we move over to Britain and the British Library archives, it's a slightly different corpus because this is Thèse soutenue, that is to say, that one's not been finished. But the most important thing that you can see is that. Qu'est-ce que j'ai fait avec ça? En rouge, les thèmes beaucoup plus populaires en Grande-Bretagne. En bleu, c'est beaucoup plus populaire en France. Voilà. So, much more popular in Britain. Political history, economic history, social history, and much more popular in France, history of art and history of ideas. Où est-ce qu'il est parti? Ah oui, en fait, toute l'information que j'ai donnée sur l'histoire culturelle, c'est ici. Cultural history is more than twice as popular in France than it is in Britain. That's right, yeah. Okay, and I think that just give me a moment to get my ideas together. Okay, so the last thing I wanted to. Say just a little bit about. Yes. Was this idea of thick description. I'm going to stop that there.